starting up again. She turns her head slightly so that her cheek rests on my chest, and she feels so small, so vulnerable, nestled against me. I can't help but hold on to her tighter. I have no idea what I'm doing, so I'm going on instinct, and every instinct says that holding her, comforting her, is right.
"How did you find me?"
she finally whispers against my chest. "I heard you scream." She nods, her body shaking with another sob.
"I remember screaming."
"I'm glad you did," I say, still stroking her hair. "Or else..."
"I'd be dead now."
"Yes," I whisper, the word bitter on my lips. She takes a deep breath, but it's ragged. "Breathe again," I say, "slowly now." She does, and it's a little easier this time. "One more time," I say, rubbing her back. This time it's deep and smooth and slow.
"I'm so tired," she says,
her tears subsiding bit by bit as her weight falls heavy against me. I shift a little in the bed so that my back is against the headboard. She nestles closer to me, but her rhythmic breathing, intermingled with soft, leftover sobs, tells me that she's fallen asleep. I think about Annie, who needs milking, and the eggs waiting for me in the henhouse. The garden should be fertilized, and I religiously chop wood for 2 hours every day from May to October, so that I'll have a pile large enough to last through the cold fall, winter, and early spring months. Now that it's summertime, I should be fishing every other day, and freezing or drying my catch. There are little repairs I should be making on the cabin, and crops that need tending in the garden. But this human being, the beautiful girl asleep on my chest, her ear over my heart, needs me right now. So I hold her close and let my eyes shut as the sun lowers over the greatest mountain. I don't really know her. I don't have any right to her. I shouldn't get attached to her. In a handful of days, she will be gone. But right now, there is simply nowhere else on earth I'd rather be.
Chapter 13. Bryn. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. My eyes open slowly to the rhythm of Cassidy's heartbeat, and I find the room cast in a pink glow. Turning my head slightly, I realize it's dawn. The black outline of Katahdin stands majestically in the distance, with pink and orange light in parallel streaks behind it. The sun is still hidden by the mountain, where my backpack, holding Jem's phone, has been abandoned. When Cassidy told me that he'd left my backpack behind, its loss was a stab to my heart. But when I discovered he'd carried me 7 miles, an unimaginable distance over rough ground in torrential rain, on his back to safety, it disarmed me completely. The walls behind which my tears and fears were held crumbled and fell. His chest is solid and warm under my head, and his arms still hold me as they did when I was falling asleep. We've slept like this all night, I guess, and it surprises me that sleeping a whole night in Cassidy's arms, an intimate act that requires so much vulnerability and trust, feels so organic to me, especially since I haven't slept with anyone in a long time. I lift my head and peek up at his face, at his pillowed lips, slightly open in sleep, and the 3 beauty marks on his otherwise rugged cheek. His beard has grown in from last night, and I can see a pulse beating in his throat, a little beacon that pronounces his strength every few seconds. This man saved my life. Several times. Once on the mountain when he stopped Wayne, twice when he carried me to safety, 3 times when he cared for my injuries. I am in awe of his selflessness, grateful for such profound kindness and care from a stranger. I lean back down and close my eyes, breathing in his scent. The smell of his cotton flannel is familiar and comforting, and I long to drift back to sleep in his arms, but one thing is stopping me. My bladder is so full, it hurts. I need a bathroom. I roll onto my back and pull myself up into a sitting position beside him with a grimace of breath-catching pain. On my left is the wall. On my right, Cassidy. And for the first time, spread out beside me, I realize how big he really is. He is sitting up in bed, but his bare feet still hang over the edge. I don't want to wake him, but I don't know how to maneuver my body over his when my hip screams in pain every time I move. "Cassidy?" I whisper, shaking his shoulder. "Cassidy."
"Hmm?"
He sighs in his sleep, murmuring softly.
"Let it go. Please, let it go."
I don't know what he's talking about, but he must be having a pretty intense dream because he's frowning. "Cassidy?"
"Hmm? What?"
He jolts awake, blue and green eyes opening wide.
"Huh?"
"Where's the bathroom?" I ask, keeping my voice soft. He scrunches his eyes shut and scrubs a hand over his forehead.
"You gotta get out of here. You gotta go."
"Exactly," I confirm, nodding emphatically. "I gotta go. Now." He lowers his hand and opens his eyes, blinking at me for a moment as though confused by our conversation.
"What?"
"I have to go," I say, worried that if he doesn't help me out of the bed, I'm going to pee in it.
"To the bathroom."
"Yes," I nod, glancing down at his legs, which take up more than half of the twin bed. "Can you..." His legs slide off the bed, and he sits up as I push down the covers and pull my bare legs out from under the sheets. For a split second, I'm aware of how naked they look. "He took off your clothes." The thought passes through my head, but I put it aside. I'll ask him about that later.
"You know where?"
he asks, then quickly answers his own question, his voice still sleep-disoriented.
"No, she don't know where. You have to show her, Cass."
"Cass." As a nickname, it's perfect, and I find myself wanting to say it just to see what it feels like falling from my lips. He stands up, stretching his arms over his head before offering me his hands.
"Move slow."
I scoot to the end of the bed and take his hands, leaning heavily on them as I drop one foot, then the other, to the floor. As I stand up, my hip throbs with such intense, searing pain I cry out, and Cass squeezes my hands.
"It's okay,"
he says, softly.
"No hurry."
"Easy for you to say," I think. "I'm about to pee on his floor." It takes me a second to adjust to the pain of standing, and though my bladder is throbbing with a different sort of discomfort, I force myself to stay still for a second. I don't want to move too quickly and pull the stitches.
"I know you're hurting," he says. "I'll get you a painkiller while you, you know, do your business."
I nod gratefully, following his lead as he pulls me slowly from the bed to the curtain.
"It'll get better," he says. "I promise."
We've entered a living room, and I want to look around, to find clues about where I am and who he is, but there's no time to linger right now. I follow him into a dark hallway, and he drops one of my hands to push open a door. I step inside. The bathroom is dark, lit only by the rising sun filtering through the window and a nightlight on the sink. My fingers search for a light switch on the wall inside the door. "Where's the light?"
"Isn't one."
I blink at this odd answer as he pulls the door shut, leaving me alone. My eyes adjust to the dim light as I brace one hand on the sink and pull down my underpants. As I lower myself to the toilet seat, I endure a whole new wave of unforgiving pain. But after I'm finally seated, my bladder empties quickly, and for a moment, my relief overrides my discomfort. Not in a hurry to stand up again, I look around. It's the tiniest bathroom I've ever seen. Just enough room for the toilet, the small sink beside me, and a shower stall across from me. Behind the door is a hook that holds a solitary, yellowish-gray towel. Cassidy's, no doubt, since he lives here alone. The sparse room is clean and very tidy, with a hand towel on a rack beside the sink and no other decoration.
In other words, nothing else to look at. And no clues about my host. I take a deep breath and hold it as I reach down for my panties, but as I pull them up, my stomach flips over. They're grayish and frayed around the edges like they've been washed about 100 times. But more importantly, they're not mine, which means Cassidy undressed me all the way and helped me into these panties. My cheeks flush with heat as I imagine being completely naked while I was unconscious. I mean, I know that he saved my life and I'm grateful, but realizing that he's seen me naked makes me uncomfortable. Like he took something that didn't belong to him. Trying to shake off the feeling, I force myself into a standing position, gasping at the pain, and pull the granny panties up over my bandages. I'm further creeped out by wearing someone else's old undergarments, but I tell myself not to be stupid. I'm lucky he found me, lucky he carried me somewhere safe, and lucky there was extra underwear to be borrowed at all. Turning to flush the toilet, I find there's no handle. I look to the left and right. Nothing. Cassidy? I call.
Yeah?
He answers from outside the door. How do I flush the toilet?
Don't worry about it,
he says.
I'll take care of it.
No, you won't. That's okay, I'll do it. Where's the handle?
It's a composting unit,
he says.
A what unit?
I stare at the toilet, feeling annoyed with it, then turn back to the door. I'm sorry, what?
It's not a regular toilet. You don't flush it.
Huh. Okay. I am from San Francisco, so I have obviously seen low-flow toilets, but a composting toilet is new to me. I sigh and decide to fight the flush-my-own-pee battle another time. Reaching for the sink faucet, I find there's only one lever, and when I turn it on, my hands are jet-blasted with a rush of freezing cold water. I yelp with surprise, quickly turning off the water and staring at the tiny sink like it has hidden fangs.
Okay in there,
he asks. Your water's very cold. Like Arctic cold.
It comes from a cistern on top of the house,
he explains.
It gets chilly at night.
No electricity and no plumbing. Is he Amish? Where the hell am I anyway? I see, I say, though my questions are piling up like crazy. I'm about to ask one, in fact, when I look up to see the face looking back at me in the mirror. Oh, sweet Jesus. It's me. My lips part, and for a second I feel dizzy looking back at a stranger. My face is bruised, with cuts and scrapes, and my lips are puffy and scabbed where they were split. On my forehead, there is a white bandage. I pull on the corner to find an ugly gash beneath and quickly recover it with the dressing. Taking a shaking breath, I lift the t-shirt I'm wearing and count 6 separate bandages on my left side. Some are stained with blood that has seeped through and dried. Tears start falling as I realize how badly battered I am. It's too much to process.
Bryn, you okay?
I'm...
Hey, can I come in?
I can barely speak from crying, but manage to croak. Okay. He opens the door carefully, looking in without opening it all the way. When he sees me looking at myself in the mirror, he sighs.
Oh, Bryn.
You really hurt me. Cassidy nods in sympathy, but his eyes narrow and his jaw flexes. I think he's controlling his anger for my benefit, and something about witnessing his restraint makes me feel safe, makes me feel stronger. How long will it take for them to heal?
Stitches can probably come out in 2 weeks.
I take a shaking breath, anxious to change the subject. Looking down at the underwear I'm wearing, I slide my eyes back up to Cassidy. You changed my underwear. I was naked. His eyes widen as he stares at me in surprise, his Adam's apple bobbing.
I had to.
I need to know that he didn't abuse the power he'd had over me. Had to? He nods. Had to, not wanted to? I ask, holding his eyes.
I didn't,
he whispers, his cheeks flushing, his breathing quickening.
I didn't hurt you.
That's a weird thing to say, I think. Hurt me? What do you mean? He shakes his head vigorously.
I would never hurt you.
He's so focused on this notion of hurting me that he doesn't seem to understand what I'm asking him. I want to know why he took off my underwear, because I wasn't conscious when it happened, and I don't know him well enough to trust him with my naked, unconscious body. I need for him to tell me about it now. I don't want a black hole in my memories. Cassidy, why did you take off my underwear? I ask him directly.
Because it was bloody, he says. You'd been stabbed through the fabric.
My heart drops. Of course. Oh, then he blurts out.
And then I had to take them off again when you soiled yourself. I couldn't just let you lie in.
He gestures with his hands, dropping his eyes to the floor as his cheeks flush with color. I blink at his chest as I process his words. Oh, my God. I shit or pissed myself, and he had to change my underwear. When he said had to, he meant it literally, and now I am ready to die of embarrassment. If a huge sinkhole suddenly opened up in this tiny bathroom and swallowed me whole, I'd be okay with that. Alas, no sinkhole. Just Cassidy, who dealt with my bloody, shredded underwear once, and a disgusting mess in them later. No doubt he was trying to preserve my feelings by not mentioning either. Oh, I say weakly, my cheeks aflame. You had to.
That's what I said, he muttered. And now come out of there and let me deal with the toilet.
For the first time since I've met Cassidy, his voice is cool. I've offended him, and I couldn't be more sorry. He carried me down a mountain to his home, sewed up my stab wounds, changed my soiled underwear, made me soup, slept beside me so I'd feel safe, and the first chance I get, I essentially ask him if he'd treated himself to a free peep show. I'm ashamed of myself. I reach for the doorknob, opening the door completely and taking a step toward him. Placing my hand on his arm, I squeeze gently and say, Cass, I didn't mean to accuse you of anything. I had no right to question you. I'm sorry. His eyes search mine with an intensity I can barely stand.
You had a right,
he finally mutters. I trust you, I say, surprised to discover I mean the three words without conditions or reservations.
You probably shouldn't,
he says, his voice soft, low, and gritty, like he's straining for control. Then he sidesteps me into the bathroom and closes the door. I stare at the door, my mouth open, wondering what he means. He's shown me nothing but kindness. Why shouldn't I trust him? What has he done that merits my distrust? Nothing. And yet I am unsettled by the comment. My head aches as I make my way back down the hall, and I'm breathless by the time I reach the living room, winded by just a few steps. I place my hand on the hallway wall, looking around the living room as I catch my breath. Like the rest of Cassidy's house, it's small, but tidy, clean and comfortable. A couch with an outdated pattern sits against the wall to my left, facing six picture windows like the ones in the bedroom. The view of Katahdin is just as spectacular. In front of the sofa, there is a large coffee table on top of a braided rug, and the wood planking on the floor is clean and shiny. I realize that the fireplace to my right accounts for the wall of brick in my room. It's the backside of the chimney. On either side of the couch are end tables with lanterns, and over the couch is a large picture of an older man standing behind a young woman in her 30s. She sits on a stool, holding a little boy on her lap who appears to be about 5 or 6. I take 2 steps closer to the picture to look at the faces, grateful for the sun breaking over the mountains, shining like a spotlight on the portrait. There is no doubt that the little boy is Cassidy, and the date on the bottom reads 1995. I do some quick math in my head and estimate his current age at about 27, which surprises me a little because he seems younger to me.
Need some help getting back to bed.
I turn to see Cassidy standing beside me. This is you? I ask, looking back up at the photo.
Yeah.
Is that your mom? When he doesn't answer, I turn back to him. He nods, but doesn't offer any additional information. His face is tight, almost like it's closing up before my eyes, which is strange, because the portrait isn't hidden or anything. It's right out in the open where anyone could see it. That makes it free game for conversation, right? I turn back to it. Is that your fault?
How about we get you back to bed now?
He says, quickly, a sharpness to his voice. I'm not trying to pry.
I know,
he says, holding out his hand to show me half of a blue pill.
But if you're going to take a painkiller, you should be lying down.
Yeah, I say, looking at the pill longingly. You're right. He helps me to the bedroom and into the bed, giving me a fresh glass of cold water to wash down the pill.
Sleep a while, he says. When you wake up, I'll make you some eggs, okay?
I nod. Thanks, Cassidy. For everything. He gulps, his eyes darting away from mine before returning to rest on them. They are so warm, so tender. My stomach flutters in a way I'd almost forgotten it could. I have a quick flashback to falling asleep in his arms, to waking up with my head resting on his heart.
You're welcome, Bryn,
he says, in that low voice that sings Beatles songs like lullabies. Then he turns and walks over to the curtain.
I'll be here when you wake up.
Here. Just like Jem. Which makes me realize that I've been awake for a while now, and this is the first time Jem has even crossed my mind.
Chapter 14. Cassidy. As soon as she is asleep, I take down the portrait of me and Mama with Gramp, wrapping it in a plastic garbage bag and placing it on the top level of the barn, where we store things we don't need but aren't ready to throw away. Then I go back into the house and take down all the pictures of me and my family, grabbing a photo album on the coffee table on my way back to the barn. Though there are no pictures of my father in the house, I still don't want to talk about my family, because questions about my parents will inevitably arise. Heck, I couldn't even let her finish the word father before the pressure in my chest had me so panicked and lightheaded, I'm surprised I didn't pass out. And in the bathroom before, when she lightly accused me of taking a peek at her naked body while she was unconscious? The guilt I felt. The fear. My God. I don't know how I remained standing. The truth is, yes, I needed to change her underthings, but I also peeked. And worse, I wanted to. I desperately wanted to look at her, to see the tender, vulnerable curves and valleys of her body. I want to look at her every minute she's in my presence. Drinking her in is quickly becoming an addiction. Does that make me bad? Does that make me like Paul Isaac Porter? I promised Mama and Gramp that I'd live quiet so I couldn't hurt anyone, but here I am with a woman living in Mama's room, and my heart feels bleak when I confess to myself that I like her. I feel myself growing attached to her. I pull the curtain to a room aside and feel my whole body recharge just from the simple act of checking on her. The covers rise and fall as she sleeps with her dark hair spread out on the stark white cotton of the pillow. My heart swells until my chest feels tight, and I rub the place over my heart with my palm, wondering if... I mean, if there were a parallel universe in which I was allowed to consider a future with her. One day, I won't ache with reverence at the very sight of her. I wonder if I could ever take her for granted, and somehow I know I never would. Not that it matters. My dreams of devotion are pointless. I remind myself that during a human being's lifetime, their DNA methylation, or how genes are activated, is not static. For instance, a change in DNA methylation patterns can turn on a gene that should have stayed off and cause cancer. Should my methylation change over time, the wrong gene could be turned on and I could become a serial killer. I have no way to know and no way to prevent such an outcome. But, live quiet and no matter what happens inside of you, you won't never be able to hurt someone, Cassidy. I close the curtain to shield Bryn from my view and turn to face the living room. A low bookcase is built into the wall under the windows, looking out at Katahdin, and the shelves are full to bursting with books about heredity, DNA, nature versus nurture, neurobiology, coding and decoding, gene expression and regulation. I have read every single one, but the answer I want, the answer my mother so desperately searched for, isn't in any of them. There are no guarantees, and only a monster would gamble someone else's life when the possibility of a tragic outcome is so much higher than average. My fists clench by my sides in frustration. I need to do something. I need a release. Shrugging angrily out of my flannel, I throw it on the floor, then pull my t-shirt over my head and step outside, into the cool morning. I cut down 2 trees the week before last, and both need to be chopped for firewood. It feels good, relieving, to swing the axe again, the physical exertion welcomed after 3 days of sitting by Bryn's bedside and sleeping semi-supine last night beside her. As the steel blade splits the wood, I let myself think about last night for a few minutes. The way it felt to hold a woman in my arms, the overwhelming feelings of protectiveness and gratitude that I have now experienced, it's something I never want to unknow. She will leave someday soon, but I will hold on to those memories forever. I will be grateful for them, for the opportunity to relive the night I fell asleep with a woman, with Bryn asleep against my heart. I flick a glance at the house as I lean down to lift another large circular log. She's as weak as a kitten right now, and I'm still not sure she's out of the woods in terms of infection. If all goes well and she manages to escape infection, the stitches can come out in 7 or 8 more days, but I wouldn't trust them on the back of my ATV for another 2 or 3 weeks after that, which means that we still have about a month together. A month. I swing back and bury the axe in the chopping stump, then reach down to collect what I've split, relishing the punishing texture of the bark against my bare forearms and chest. It's a reality check I need. Walking over to the 6-foot-high pile of logs behind the barn, I lift the tarp that keeps it dry and add the pieces I'm carrying. A month with Bryn. Why this hasn't occurred to me yet is beyond me, probably because I've been totally consumed with her survival and haven't had time to map out the immediate future. If I feel like this about her after 3 days, how in the hell am I going to feel after 4 weeks? Lord, I need to come up with some strategies to ensure I don't become any more attached to her. I need to figure out how to keep my distance. I flex my muscles in the morning sun and reach up to the sky, appreciating the burn caused by an hour of chopping. That's one thing I can do. I can stay busy. Really, I can't even afford the time I've already lost sitting by her bed. The garden and animals need daily, constant tending. Wood needs chopping, and I should be making those summer repairs to the house. The windmill behind the barn could use some maintenance, the solar panels need a good cleaning, and I should tinker with the brakes on the ATV a little. If there's no time to sit and gaze at her like a lovesick pup, it'll be easier not to develop feelings. Another idea. I can stay out of the house. She can have the house for the next few weeks. It'll be her domain. I don't even have to sleep in my bedroom at the end of the hallway, just past the bathroom. I can sleep in the sleeping porch back behind the house, piss in the woods, and use the outdoor shower. I'll stay out of her way when I use the kitchen once or twice a day, or maybe I'll go the extra mile, pack up meals for myself all at once, and keep them in the root cellar under the barn. Then I won't have to go inside the house more than once or twice a week, unless it's raining real hard. And even then, I suppose Annie wouldn't mind a night of company in her small, leaky barn. You don't want to get more attached, I tell myself aloud as I head back to the stump. Intense feelings can lead to changes in behavior, so stop being stupid. Does she need to be here? Sure, for now. But she's not your house guest, and she's certainly not some potential love interest. She's just a girl who got into some trouble and needed your help. Soon she'll be gone. I still have to interact with her, of course, especially over the next 3 or 4 days. She'll need help cleaning and changing her dressings. And while she's recovering in Mama's bed, I'll need to bring her food and drink. But once she's well enough to tend to herself, I'll make myself scarce until it's time to take her down to Millinocket. Feeling stronger, though undeniably melancholy, I pull the axe from the block and place another full-size log on the stump for chopping. I shuck off my jeans and stand under the outdoor showerhead, grabbing a bottle of Dr. Bronner's liquid soap from a small shelf affixed to the side of the house and pumping a handful into my palm. I work it into my hair, then rinse. It doesn't make a lot of bubbles because it's biodegradable, but it still does the job. I'm still working through the last few cases of gallon bottles that Grant bought. If I mix the concentrated Castile soap with water in a foamer bottle, it lasts 10 times as long, and I only end up needing to use 2 or 3 gallon bottles a year. Sometimes it feels like I'll never run out, and I wonder if that was Gramps' intention, to stock me for life, so I'd never have reason to leave. I run my hands over my soap-slicked pectoral and abdominal muscles, which are hard and well-defined. As my fingers slip over my nipples, I have a sudden mental flashback to Brin's, which were dusty pink and delicate. I only saw them for a moment before I forced myself to look away, but they were perfect, and seeing them with my own eyes was the most erotic moment of my life. Suddenly, the blood in my head races down to my pecker, making it stiffen and grow. I close my eyes and flatten my hands against the house, letting the cold water run down my back while I give in to the feeling of sexual excitement. It's not something I experience regularly, and even when I do, I try to control it. My father's hobby of raping his victims prior to murdering them makes me cautious in my approach to my own sexuality. Even when I allow myself to feel some brief physical pleasure, I rarely allow myself to totally surrender to it. Mama and Gramp never sat me down and discussed reproduction with me, though I had a crash course when I came across 2 of our goats, Hector and Dolly, one fall morning when I was 13. I watched in fascination as Hector mounted Dolly over and over again, sticking his pink, pencil-thin penis into her rear. I had no idea that Dolly's kids the following spring were a result of this exercise, but I understood that the act of sex was something that happened naturally among living things. A larger share of my education came when I was 16. Gramp returned from his monthly trip to the Millinocket post office with 3 magazines in a brown paper bag and handed them to me. I know you ain't going to meet a girl out here, but I figure every man should at least know what his peck is for. Inside the magazines were pictures of naked women, some in sexual positions with men and other women, and plenty of accompanying narratives about what was going on between them. I masturbated for the first time staring at the pictures in those magazines, though I felt guilty afterward, uncertain if what I'd just done was right or wrong. I still have an ambiguous relationship with my own sexuality. I know I am heterosexual, and there are parts of me that long to be sexually active with a woman, but at this point my personal desires are so tangled up with my fears about turning out like my father that it's a love-hate relationship. Right this second, though, as cold water slips down my back and my rigid length strains against my stomach, it feels more like love than hate. As I remember Bryn's body while stroking my own, it feels like its own kind of worship, and I allow it. Letting my head fall back, I think of the gentle weight of her body on my chest, the sound of her laughter when I knocked on the curtain. and the touch of her hand on my arm when she apologized to me this morning. I cry out, closing my eyes and coming in hot spurts against the side of the house, breathless and panting. I don't want to open my eyes. I don't want to feel bad about something that feels so good. I don't want to feel ashamed for touching myself and drawing pleasure from my body. I don't want to feel guilty about thinking of Bryn as I climaxed. More than anything, I don't want to be Paul Isaac Porter's son. But I am. I open my eyes, cup water in my hands, and throw it against the side of the house to erase any traces of my orgasm. Then I turn off the water, wrap a towel around my body, and head back inside the house with a heavy, unsettled heart. After I chop wood, milk Annie, and shower, I go back outside to collect eggs from the girls, Macy, Casey, Lacey, Gracie, Tracy, and Stacy, avoiding a peck to the hand by Tyrannosaurus Rex, the lone rooster, who is protective of his hens. I get 8 eggs in all and bring them inside to the kitchen. The clock over the sink says it's 10 o'clock. That's 4 hours from when Bryn took half a Percocet. Although the pills are supposed to have a 3-year shelf life, I've kept the bottle in the cellar, where it's cool and dark, and they appear to be managing her pain, though the pill should be wearing off right about now. I'm hopeful that when she wakes up, she'll be ready to eat something substantial. She hasn't had a proper meal since I found her. I crack all 8 eggs into a bowl and add some of Annie's milk. She's a La Mancha goat, so while her milk isn't creamy, it's a decent approximation of whole cow's milk in consistency, and sweeter than milk from Sonnens or Oberhaslis, both of which we've kept in the barn at different times. Whisking the eggs, I add a little salt and pepper, then place Gramps' old cast-iron skillet on one of the burners. The 20-inch stove has a battery ignition but cooks with propane, and if I'm sparing, using it once a day, I can go for months without needing to refill the tank. I pour a drop of olive oil in the skillet, then add the eggs, inhaling deeply as they sizzle and scramble. Taking 2 plates from the cabinet, I place them side by side on the counter, marveling at them for a quiet moment. I am cooking for 2 people today, something that I haven't done in such a long, long time.
What's for lunch, Mama?
Fetch 2 plates for me, Cass. I'm making grilled cheese.
I pull a chair to the sink and climb up so I can reach the cupboards.
Mama, when am I going back to school?
It's been a year since the incident with JJ and Kenny in the bathroom, and I keep waiting for her to tell me we're moving back to town. I open the cabinet and pull out 2 stoneware plates, holding them in my hands as she inhales sharply enough for me to hear.
Never,
she finally says, buttering the 4 pieces of bread on the cutting board roughly, angrily. She clears her throat, looking up at me. Taking the plates from my hands, she lowers them to her sides, which makes her hands look like big white frisbees.
You remember your...
She pauses, looking at my face carefully.
Daddy?
Not so well, I say. I have some memories of him, but they're few and far between, and none of them makes me feel happy. He was just someone who appeared every so often and then left again. I never knew him. Not really. She nods, looking down at the floor.
Come on down from there.
I hop to the floor and drag the chair back to the table. When I turn back to the counter, Mama has tears running down her face. Suddenly she raises the plates over her head and drops them to the floor with a furious scream. Open-mouthed with shock, I stare at her, wondering what to do. Shards of broken white ceramic are scattered across the floor, and she sobs softly, her shoulders trembling, her lip quivering.
"He's gone, Cass,"
she whispers, raising her eyes to mine.
"Someone,"
she whimpers softly.
"He's gone now."
I know that my father was arrested and found guilty of hurting some ladies me and Mama never met, and I know that he was set to die at some point. I figure that point has now come and gone. The thing is, I don't much care. I don't care that he's gone. If anything, I'm glad. He scared me more than I ever loved him, and I much prefer living here with Mama and Gramp. But seeing Mama this upset makes my guts tighten.
Mama?
She turns to me, placing her hands on my arms and looking deeply into my eyes.
Am I the stupidest person living on God's green earth? I shake my head. No, Mama. You're the best person living on God's green earth. She yanks me into her arms, hugging me tightly as she presses her lips to the top of my head. You're good, Cass. Remember that. Always remember that. You're a good boy. Be good. Stay good, Cassidy. Cassidy? Cass? Someone is calling my name. Coming. I turn off the burner, pull the eggs from the heat, and go check on Bryn.
Chapter 15. Bryn. When I wake up, my hip hurts. Sharp pains alternate with a dull, burning throb. But I suppose pain is to be expected when you're healing from injuries like mine. Don't be a baby, Bryn. Be strong. To distract myself, I breathe through my nose and my mouth waters. Someone is making food and it smells beyond delicious. Cassidy? I call as my stomach growls loudly enough to wake the dead. Are you there? No answer. Cassidy! Cass?
Coming.
I brace my hands on either side of my hips, lift my head, and slide back a little into a sitting position by the time he pushes the curtain aside. I have seen his face several times now, but I am struck by its singularity all over again. It's not just his fascinating mismatched eyes or those three beguiling beauty marks that tease me. It's not even how tall and strong he is, though he's wearing a t-shirt that shows off his insanely toned arms with the muscle definition of a lumberjack. It's a lot more than how he looks. It's that my heart has been moved by his kindness to me, by the fact that he has saved my life multiple times and continues to take care of me. A stranger. When I think of him carrying me on his back for hours and hours on end through that unforgiving rain, I want to cry until all the tears in my body are spent. I can't remember the last time I met someone so selfless. It makes my heart ache a little. Hi, I say softly.
How are you feeling?
I take a deep breath and the burning in my side flares to an almost unbearable place. I hold my breath until it subsides a little. It hurts, but I'm okay.
I guess it'll be sore for a while.
He tilts his head to the side.
Up for some eggs? They're fresh.
Sure, I say with a grateful smile. They smell delicious. He disappears, only to return a moment later with a plate covered with scrambled eggs. My mouth waters as he sets the dish on the end table beside me, but I stop him as he turns to leave. Wait, aren't you having some? He hooks a thumb toward the kitchen.
Yeah.
Do you want to bring yours in here? I ask, my voice hopeful. He holds my eyes for a second, then looks away.
Thought I'd just eat quick. Lots of work to catch up on.
Oh, I murmur, surprised by how disappointed I feel.
Hey,
he says quickly.
Sure, I can. I can take a break. I'll bring mine in here with you.
His jeans are worn, and he wears them low on his hips, I notice, as he walks back toward the kitchen to grab his plate. When he moves, I can see a strip of tanned skin between the jeans and his shirt, and I feel my cheeks flush as he turns around and catches me gawking, though there's no look of teasing or triumph on his face. It's almost like he didn't notice, or that he's so modest he didn't correlate my ogling with his muscular body. I pick up my plate and am digging into the eggs when he returns and takes a seat in the rocker on the other side of the end table. This is... I say, swallowing a mouthful.
The girls do good work,
he answers, taking a smaller and more polite-sized bite of his own. The girls? What girls?
Macy, Casey, Lacey, Gracie, Tracy, and Stacy.
My fork freezes halfway to my mouth, loaded with fluffy yellow goodness. Who?
Macy, Casey, Lacey, Gracie, Tracy, and Stacy.
He chuckles softly. The hens. My brain acknowledges that he's talking about chickens, but my heart is completely distracted by the soft, low rumble of his laugh. Do it again. For the love of all that's holy, please laugh again. The girls rhyme, I observe, taking another bite.
Yes, they do,
he agrees. But he doesn't laugh, and I feel cheated. Did you name them? He nods. Very interesting.
How so?
You don't look like the type to name your chickens all rhymy and silly.
Are you saying I'm no fun?
I shake my head, grinning at him. Just serious.
Is that bad?
He asks, looking at me closely like he expects an honest answer. Not to me, I say. I like serious. He turns back to his food, but I think I see the corner of his lip twitch, like maybe he approves of my answer, though he doesn't say so. I shovel the last of my eggs into my mouth and put the plate back on the table. I think I've been here for about 4 days now, but I'm not sure. Either way, I should probably call my parents and let them know I'm not dead. Cassidy, can I use your phone? He jerks his head to look at me.
Telephone.
I nod. Landline or cell, whatever you've got handy. I want to call my parents and let them know I'm okay. He shakes his head.
I don't have a telephone.
I feel my face go slack. No phone? I've never heard of such a thing. What do you mean?
I don't have anyone to call,
he says, simply, spearing another bite of egg. No family?
I still have a great uncle over in New Hampshire, but we lost touch a long while back.
No family? No friends? I'm about to pry, but force myself not to. Maybe he's taking a break from the world for a good reason. Didn't I live like a hermit in my apartment for 2 years? Pot, meat kettle. I have no right to pick at him. Okay, I say, working to control my curiosity. Can I use your laptop? He stops chewing and stares at me.
You want to use my lap?
Your laptop. Your computer? I could email them.
Oh,
he says, looking relieved as he swallows.
Computers. Right. They have computers in the library over in Millinocket, but I never tried them.
You don't have... I'm staring at him, and I know it's rude, but I'm in such a total state of shock I can't help it. You don't have a computer or a cell phone or a landline?
What is that?
A landline? It's a phone on, you know, mounted to the wall with a cord that...
Oh,
he says, nodding.
A regular phone. Nope, no phone. Telos Road is 4 miles away, but there's no telephone line on Telos Road because it's mostly just for logging access.
His eyebrows furrow as he thinks about something.
Closest phone is at the Golden Bridge Campground and Store.
How far away is that?
About 15 miles. 3 or 4 miles of bushwhacking, and then another 11 or 12 on logging roads. Telos, then Golden.
Bush... what? I ask, almost feeling like we are speaking two different languages to one another.
Bushwhacking. You know, riding through the woods, rough trails, not on roads.
How do you drive if you're not on a road?
I have an ATV,
he says, as if that explains it. You have what?
An all-terrain vehicle,
he says, enunciating each word like I should know what he's talking about. I stare at him, ignoring his tone, my mouth catching flies and my eyes likely turning like pinwheels as I put the facts together. Oh my God, I murmur. No phones, no computer, no roads. You're totally isolated here. He nods at me.
Pretty much.
Why? I ask softly. Why do you live like this? The question surprises me, especially because I've already resolved not to pick at him. It's indelicate, and I grimace at the vaguely judgmental note in my tone. I'm sure Cassidy has his reasons for living apart from society. It's absolutely none of my business, and yet I'm leaning forward, staring into his eyes, my curiosity so sharp I can taste it like metal. He stares back at me, his unusual eyes locked on mine. Finally, he licks his lips and looks down at his almost empty plate.
It was my gramps' place.
Oh, like a summer place, I ask. His cheeks flush and he shrugs. I've made him uncomfortable when I really didn't want to. Are you a prepper?
A what?
Someone preparing for the end of the world? I ask, enunciating every word, because I figure turnabout is fair play. He grins at me, caught, before looking back down at his empty plate.
No, ma'am,
he answers politely. His smile, born of chagrin, is so beautiful, so welcome, I decide to keep the mood light and tease him into another. Hey, you're not on the run from the cops, are you? My plan instantly backfires. His head jerks up, and his face visibly blanches, his smile gone, his eyes wide and unsettled. It's such a complete transformation from a moment ago, I lean back, a chill slithering over my skin as I process his reaction. Oh, God, I murmur, my hands fisting in the quilt that covers me from waist to toes. Are you?
No,
he says, shaking his head vehemently.
I'm not in trouble with anyone. Not the authorities. Not anyone. I stay out of trouble. I live quiet. I can promise you that.
I know he's telling me the truth. Don't ask me how I know, I just do, though I sense there's a much larger story behind his words. Maybe he was accused of something he didn't do, or maybe he had a run-in with the cops that ended badly for him. I feel like I'm looking at the tippy top of a massive iceberg, and my curiosity is so sharp, I'm going to bleed inside from all the questions I want to ask. I opt for one. Are you hiding from someone?
No, not really.
His eyebrows crease, and he sighs, the color returning to his cheeks.
I just like living out here, is all. I won't hurt you, Bryn. I'm not some psycho. Not yet, anyway, I promise.
Again, the assurance that he won't hurt me. It has to be the fifth or sixth time he's said this. Maybe it's more than a fear of authority. Maybe he's misunderstood. Maybe he has Asperger's or a social anxiety disorder. He's smart, and he's obviously skilled in living out here. He's kept himself isolated for a long time. He's different, I think, remembering that he carried me back to safety on his back. And kind. And beautiful. And I'd like to pull him out of his shell a little, which almost makes me laugh. Me, Bryn Cadogan, self-isolated for 2 years now, eager to pull someone else out of their shell. Oh, the irony. I look up at him, and I'm sorry that his face seems troubled. I've touched a soft spot, and I'm anxious to make amends. Hey, Cass, I say, reaching out to nudge his knee with the back of my hand. I know you won't hurt me. Why would you go to all the effort to save me if you just meant to hurt me again? You don't have to keep saying it. I pause as he looks up at me, an inscrutable expression brightening his eyes. It looks like hope, and I have a notion that my words are like the sun, and Cassidy is like a sunflower after 10 straight days of rain. I trust you. You've been really good to me, really amazing. I trust you, Cassidy, okay? I'm not sure, but I think he's holding his breath as I finish speaking, and it's so touching to me, I feel my heart pinch a little. My words mean something to him. Something important.
Thank you, Bryn,
he whispers, averting his eyes as he collects our plates. He stands from the rocking chair and looks down at me, his eyes searching mine.
Do you need me to call someone for you?
You'd have to drive 15 miles each way to make a phone call.
I'll do it,
he says, his voice earnest, his face serious.
If you need me to.
I can't ask you.
You didn't. I offered.
You don't mind? He shakes his head.
I can pick up a few things while I'm there.
Relieved, I nod. I'd really appreciate it, Cass. I'll write down my parents' number.
I'll bring you a pen and paper,
he says, turning to leave. Just before he disappears through the curtain, he turns back to look at me.
Would you like a book or two to pass the time? There's a lot.
Sure, I say. I'd love one.
What do you like to read?
Instantly, my cheeks flush. My favorite kind of books are romances. His lips twitch again, and I have a sense he's on to me.
I'll bring a few to choose from.
And then he's gone. A minute later, he returns with half a Percocet, a glass of water, paper, a pen, and 3 books. Then came You by Lisa Kleypas, Potent Pleasures by Eloisa James, and Welcome to Temptation by Jennifer Cruzy. He sets the obviously well-loved novels beside me on the table, and I eye them as I swallow the half-moon blue pill. Oh, he's definitely on to me.
Will that cover you?
He asks with a small grin. Mm-hmm, I say, taking the paper and pen he's offering me and quickly writing down my parents' phone number. I refuse to be embarrassed about loving romance novels. Anyone with half a brain loves romance novels, and the rest are lying. I hand the paper to him. Their names are Jennifer and Colin Cadogan. Tell them I'm okay. I'll call them as soon as I can. He nods, taking the paper from me, folding it 3 times and putting it in his back pocket. See you soon? I ask, realizing for the first time that I'm going to be all alone in the middle of nowhere for the next few hours. He nods, grimacing as though he's just realized it too.
See you soon.
Chapter 16. Cassidy. I think about her as I ride over the rough terrain between my homestead and Telos Road. It's not a ride I enjoy most of the time, and I like it even less today. I don't relish leaving the safety of my hidden homestead, and I'm not fond of dealing with people in general. Plus, leaving Brayne all alone at the cabin makes me uncomfortable, but letting her parents worry about her doesn't feel right either. The ride is physically demanding, and I use my whole body to stay balanced on the old quad as I dart through the woods, going faster than I should be, because I'm anxious to get where I'm going and then back home. Over the years of coming and going from my place to Telos Road, a trail of sorts has developed. Though, to discourage visitors, I purposely never filled it with gravel or trimmed back the overgrowth. I want it to be hidden. During the bumpy ride, my conversation with Brayne weighs on me. It illuminates how isolated from the world I have become. Heck, when she asked to use my laptop, I thought she was asking to sit on my lap for some reason, and imagining her there made my adrenaline rush so fast and furious I felt weak for a hot minute. But apparently a laptop is some sort of computer, and a landline is a regular phone, like the one we had in my house when I was little. And I know what email is because I spent a few hours at Millinocket Memorial Library last fall, and I saw signs about it over by the computers, but I wouldn't have the first clue how to use it. What really jarred me, however, was her asking me if I was on the run from the law or in hiding. I know she was kidding, I could tell by the tone of her voice, and by the fact that she was smiling when she said it, but it still felt a little too close to home. I mean, I'm not on the run, but I surely am hiding. I dodged trees and braced my body for roots as I raced through the woods, hating the very thought of hiding. Like I've done something shameful when I haven't. I haven't given much thought to the way I live my life. I've just accepted it as a truth. I made a promise at age 14 to live quiet, and I never really reconsidered that plan. Now, a part of me, the part that desperately hates being the son of a madman, wonders if there is any option other than hiding. Loving a woman? Being loved by her? Having a family with her? Absolutely not. All impossibilities for me if I have any sense of morality, which I do. But do I have to live alone in the middle of nowhere? Do I need to hide? Maybe, just maybe, and I'll have to give the matter a lot more thought after I've said goodbye to Bryn. I could use some of Gramps' money to move away, to set myself up somewhere different, somewhere new. I could change my name, couldn't I? Sure I could. Legally, I don't have to be Cassidy Porter. I could go to the courthouse and change my name to Cassidy.